morning, and welcome to Hancock Whitney Bank's Economic Update Call. Hancock and Whitney Bank provide this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Whitney Corporation or its affiliates. If you have any questions, please email them to david.lundgren@hancockwhitney.com. On today's call, we have investment directors Richard Chauvin and Jeffrey Tangus, and Senior Portfolio Manager Austin Zombrecker, and David Lundgren, our Chief Investment Officer, will be the moderator.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Ashley. We'll get off to discussing GDP and the economic outlook as we normally do. And first, a little bit of old news. The second quarter GDP was revised at the end of August. It was revised up to 4.2% from 4.1%. We'll have a couple more revisions before that number is final, but it's definitely going to be in that 4% range. And we're now more than two-thirds of the way through the third quarter. And generally, despite a few soft spots, the data continues to look strong, and all indications point to yet another solid quarter. And let's go ahead and break down where we are, and we'll start with the consumer. And there's really no let-up in a lot of the consumer data that we've seen that's been positive, really starting in the second quarter. As you may remember, the first quarter was pretty weak for the consumer. Consumer confidence, we're reading in August, it was the highest since 2001. The consumer is confident no matter how you slice it, either by age or by income. The consumer feels good about their financial situation, and it's showing. One reason why the consumer is so confident is that there is no let-up in the jobs data either. The unemployment rate read 3.9% in August. A lot of people anticipate that number being 3.8% in this September reading that we'll be getting in a couple weeks here. Jobless claims remain near record lows. And one thing that's kind of encouraging is that we're starting to see wages rise. If you remember, we've had a tight jobs market for a while, but you really weren't experiencing any wage growth. That number is, I'd call it creeping up. We're generally running in the 2% range. It looks like we're moving towards a 3% number, which is good, healthy growth. You don't want to see that number grow too fast, because it could become disruptive if it got into that 4% plus range. So we're seeing good, healthy growth there. So obviously wage gains are good for the consumer. And if you have a more confident, better employment numbers and making better wages, retail sales should follow, and they have. They've been impressive really for the last several months. I would say that spending habits have changed. No big secret there. A lot more shopping or spending being done online now versus in stores. But nonetheless, the consumer is still spending. Let's switch gears to business spending real quick. And in terms of confidence, a lot of survey data, whether you're talking about small business surveys or the CEO survey, those numbers are at or near record highs. The ISM manufacturing number was just released 5 minutes ago, and bear with me a second, and that was a blowout number. Survey calling for 57.6. The actual number came in at 61.3. And if I'm not mistaken, that's the strongest reading that we've seen in a very long time. Let me just check that real quick. Yeah, that's, wow. That's the strongest reading that we've seen really in a couple decades. So really good number on that ISM manufacturing number. And really what that means is that from a business standpoint, things are going well. The last indicator I'll mention is industrial production, and that also reached a new high recently in the month of August. So good news across the board. We still have a few weeks left in the third quarter, and all indications point to at least a 3% plus quarter, with many economists kind of zeroing in on that 3.5% to 3.7% range. If you've listened for a while, we often talk about the Atlanta Fed GDP Now prediction model. And our right now before that ISM manufacturing number, it's a 4.1% reading. I would expect that number to go up a little bit with that pretty robust number that we just printed within the last 5 to 10 minutes. So obviously, it's almost sounds like too good news, too much good news, but, you know, there are some possible disruptions to this positive trend, and we're going to talk about a couple of them this morning. One thing that has been making a lot of headlines from an economic and market standpoint is the possibility of inverted yield curve. Jeff Tangus is going to talk about that in a minute, but I'd say if there's a, there's an issue that ranked number one on possible disruption would be some difficulties or problems, and I don't want to use the word crisis, with the emerging markets and internationally. While the U.S. continues to power forward, things aren't as rosy around the globe. Countries making headlines in a negative way recently, Argentina, Italy, Turkey, China, you know, have all been in the headlines, and it's really, you know, I think all of the difficulties come in three main areas, and they're all interrelated, and it would be currencies, debt, and trade. And, you know, given that that's one of the more pressing issues, I wanted Richard Chauvin to talk about that this morning. And maybe, Richard, just kind of give people some background information on what's going on globally, and then maybe just kind of bring it back into how it may negatively impact here us here in the U.S. Richard, good morning.
Sure. Good morning. Good morning. I'm going to talk a little bit about just the broad situation, kind of focusing on Turkey primarily, but weave in some of those comments about debt and trade as well, Dave. So Turkey has been in the news a lot lately over the past month or so. They've been in the process of setting up a crisis with President Erdogan's policies for some time. He's been, you know, trying to create a better hold of his power in the country with populist policies decisions that have really kind of stretched the company's fundamentals, you know, done a lot of the things that shouldn't be done in international trade as well as with their, you know, fiscal policies. Despite some double-digit inflation numbers that have been heating up over there and their interest rates are extremely high because of that, the central bank at his direction injected a lot of money into the economy, which just made the situation worse. And the way things play out here, if a nation gets in some fiscal trouble, typically they want to try to put some policies in place that instills confidence among the currency trading world instead of the opposite, and he has done just the opposite. So the currency has taken the brunt of the damage since a lot of the policies in place are really not the right ones. The currency is down about 45% or more. I checked it this morning over the period from, say, June 30 through this morning. That's a pretty big hit to the economy, as you might imagine. There's some other nations as well that are vulnerable to some extent. Maybe Turkey's sort of the poster child, but the other ones, as Dave mentioned, are Argentina, Brazil, Indonesia, Chile, Colombia, are also in pretty dire straits. What they all have in common is they have lots of dollar-denominated debt, so that debt becomes more expensive as their currency weakens and the dollar strengthens, as well as they have current account deficits, which means they import more goods than they export. So it makes them very vulnerable to currency fluctuations, particularly when they go against them. Argentina, for example, is actually trying to put policies in place, and they're planning to speak to the International Monetary Fund for some assistance. But over the weekend, they announced some positive policies that normally would kind of stem the tide against them, but it didn't. It hasn't worked so far. The dollar's continued to strengthen against all these currencies, just creating more of a headwind. So we're not at a point now where any of these countries can feel comfortable that things are going in the right direction for them. And unfortunately, you know, the dollar strength, it seems a little bit ahead of itself, but on the other hand, it may not stop for a while, because what's creating this environment for a strong dollar is that our interest rates are gradually going up. We've talked about that, and Jeff continues to talk about that on the short term markets, money markets, as well as we've got this strongly growing economy, as Dave just alluded to, and it sets itself apart from the rest of the world, which is typically has had recently seen more of a moderation in growth. So it just creates an environment where the dollar becomes very attractive, and so a lot of currency flows are into the dollar right now, really putting a burden on these weaker countries. In terms of the potential impact on the U.S. of the emerging market turbulence, probably fundamentally not such a big impact is because the emerging markets only represent about 3.6% of U.S. gross domestic product. It's really more of a potential impact on the Eurozone, the European countries, where emerging market represents about 9.7% of their GDP. So almost three times as much importance there than it is to the U.S. So the only potential respite that might occur in the near term that we can see is with regard to the dollar strength, and which we might, you know, give these countries a little bit of a rest in terms of their currency, is that China has been aggressively increasing its own internal liquidity to stem the effects of a trade war, which we have talked about before and continues to be an issue. And so if China continues to aggressively do this to try to stem the effects of the trade war, you know, trying to keep their employment up and make that less of an impact on their economy, then that might stem the dollar tide and stabilize it and give these emerging market countries a chance to have some of their policies actually begin to stabilize their own currencies. In the meantime, I think we can see more damage potential from these currencies in the emerging market equity market. So it may not be over, but there is some potential for China in their effort to help themselves also help the emerging market in total. So I could go further into the China trade situation, Dave, but I don't want to overspend my time, so I'll turn it back to you.
Great. Thank you, Richard. Definitely something that we need to continue to monitor. I guess, Jeff Tangus, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
I guess the other potential concern, we've seen a lot of press lately regarding an inverted yield curve. If you look at what you can earn in a two-year right now, let's just call it roughly 260, and what you can earn in a two-year treasury, and what you can earn in a 10-year treasury is 285, 290. So there's not a real significant pickup in yield. And I guess a lot of people are concerned that if the Fed continues to raise rates, and we have a Fed meeting coming up on September 26th, you may get a yield curve where shorter-term rates are paying more than longer-term rates, and that's called an inverted yield curve. And those usually have been a pretty good predictor of recessions in the near future. So, Jeff, if you could maybe talk a little bit about what the Fed's going to do. I think the market fully anticipates them to raise rates. And do you see the yield curve inverting, and if it does, is that problematic? Jeff?
Well, first, to answer your question, is it problematic? Probably so. Everything I see, though, indicates the Fed's not likely to invert the yield curve. There's also been a lot of study that indicates that even though everybody talks to the difference between the two-year yield on Treasuries and the 10-year yield, it may be more appropriate to look at another rate, the three-month Treasury bill versus the 10-year Treasury. And if you look at that, things don't look nearly as out of line as maybe the two-year versus the 10-year. So a lot of that's inside baseball talk, but the, you know, the bottom line is the Fed is raising short-term rates, but the Fed is going to be very hesitant to invert the yield curve because, as you mentioned, most of us remember from our old eighth grade economics courses that that an inverted yield curve can indicate an economic slowdown. So the Fed, the last thing they want to do is snuff out this recovery voluntarily. So everything that the Fed Chair Jerome Powell has said, both at Jackson Hole, which was just recently, and then at the August 1st Fed meeting, indicates that the Fed is going to continue on this trajectory of gradualism. He's gone out of his way to point that out. Some people will even say, "Oh, well, look how he's sounding dovish, and he's going to let the economy run hot." But I think he's just continuing on with what his predecessor Janet Yellen said, which is they're going to raise rates slowly and methodically, and so long as inflation remains in check, which of course it has, it remains stuck at around 2%. The Fed feels really good about what they're doing. They do, and it's not even though the economy is reporting some really strong numbers in lots of ways. The trade talk is a negative to the economy if that were to turn worse. And then also housing, which is a huge part of our economy, continues to be lackluster. So it's the Fed's looking at a lot of different ways, but they have really gone out of their way to say that they're not going to do anything in a hurry. So the market has looked at that, and at this point, they're going to raise at their meeting the latter part of this month, September 26th they meet, and they're going to raise another 25 basis points. At that point, the range will be 2% to 2.25%, still very low by historical standards, still accommodative by most measurements. There's more talk of another economic term called the neutral rate, and it's basically saying, is the Fed helping or hurting the economy with their current interest rate policy? And by all measures, at this point, they're still accommodative. In other words, they're helping the economy. So they're likely to raise in September. The market also believes about a 64% probability that the Fed raises again in December. After that is where the uncertainty starts to creep in. It looks like the market doesn't think the Fed's going to do anything again till June of 2019. So at this point, the Fed is, from what they're communicating via their dot plot, which is kind of their anonymous forecast for rates, the Fed's saying they may raise next year 2 to 3 times. The market thinks maybe the Fed raises 1 to 2 times next year. But it's clear, at least to me, from the commentary coming out of the Fed, not just by the Fed Chair Powell, but by others, is that the Fed is really starting to look at the next twist in the economy, which is the tax reform benefits start to wear off and the economy slows up some, and the Fed wants to have the flexibility to take a pause, and they're talking about neutral rates, and they're doing some other things to prepare themselves as well as the market for the time comes when they do in fact take a pause from raising rates, and in all likelihood that comes sometime next year. So the Fed hasn't really changed anything that they're doing at this point. It's still gradualism. Inflation remains in check. It really, I hesitate to say the word Goldilocks, it gets overused a little bit, but we're in a pretty good situation, at least as the Fed is concerned, where they can gradually nudge rates higher without inflation being an issue. The economy stays good. Remember, the Fed has a dual mandate. Their job is to have stable prices and full employment. And by both measures, they're hitting the mark. So the Fed's in a pretty good spot right now. A couple other little side issues with the Fed. They recently confirmed, the Senate confirmed, the Fed vice chair, the second most powerful position, Richard Clarida. And so now they've got a full complement there on the Fed Open Market Committee with that confirmation. So outside of the Fed in Europe, as Richard and Dave mentioned, things are still sluggish. The European Central Bank is still in accommodative mode. They're actually still doing quantitative easing. They're going to likely wind that down at the end of this year. And they still have basically zero interest rates on the short end. So they are very, very accommodative. And depending upon whether their economy actually catches fire next year and gets some traction, will determine whether they start to raise rates. So the Fed has been active. It's been interest rates in general have fluctuated in a very narrow range. Again, with the curve being so flat, it's been a very quiet time, generally speaking, as far as government interest rates are concerned, while around the world rates continue to be very low, which is causing us to have a strong dollar. So there's a lot going on at the Fed behind the scenes, Dave, but generally speaking, it is steady as she goes in the world of interest rates.
All right, great. Jeff, I'm really impressed that you studied the inverted yield curve in eighth grade.
Thanks, Dave.
Might explain your future profession. Austin Zombrecher, good morning.
Morning, Dave. How are you?
Good. For those of you that don't know Austin, he's sitting in for Greg Hedleski, who's on vacation today. Austin is one of our senior portfolio managers and manages our dynamic asset allocation strategy, as well as serves as co-manager on the Birken Road Small Cap Fund. So, Austin, let's talk about the equity markets for a minute. And August was a pretty solid month, and I think it followed a theme that we've seen really for most of the year, and you could even argue for the last couple years, where we saw U.S. stocks do fairly well. International stocks either, you know, were slightly positive, or if you're even talking about emerging markets, struggled a bit. So if you could maybe provide us some color on the month and then your thoughts on where we go from here. Austin?
Yeah, sure. No problem. You know, first I'd say, as I was kind of writing down some notes, it really was kind of more of the same, like you mentioned before, Dave. A lot of similar themes to what we've had all year. So the broadest measure of the global stock market, the MSCI ACWI, had a very solid month. It was up 0.8%, but that really doesn't tell the whole story. When you look at the international markets, the international developed markets, the MSCI EAFE, they were actually down 1.9%. That was led lower primarily by Europe, which was down over 2%, which had some issues in financials as well as the UK as they worked through some of their Brexit-related issues. The emerging markets, which also make up part of that ACWI index, were down 2.7%, and that really was highlighted and drawn down by the Latin American troubles that occurred. The Latin American broad index was down 8.3%, and that was led lower by Brazil, which was down almost 12%, with banks in Brazil being the biggest culprit there. On the other side, you know, how did that ACWI go up 0.8% if the international markets are all going down? Well, you mentioned it before, and it's the U.S. stock market. The S&P was up 3.3% for August. The Russell 2000, the small caps, were up 4.1% for August. And from a sector breakdown, stop me if you've heard this before, the best performing sector were tech and discretionary stocks. Tech was up 7%. And the worst performing sectors were energy and material stocks. Energy was down 3.3%, even though crude oil was up 2.2%. So what's driving those solid returns, very strong returns in the U.S.? Well, quite simply, earnings. After-tax profits were up 16% in the second quarter. That was the largest gain in over 6 years. And it was boosted primarily by the tax cuts. Corporate taxes were down by 33% year over year. On a per-share earnings basis, the large caps were up 25%, and sales and large caps were up 9.5%, and small caps fared even better. The per-earnings share was up 35%. and sales up 10.5%. The one kind of negative there, and not particularly surprising, but earnings abroad fell for the first time quarter over quarter for a few years. Again, more of the same. What happened? What led the breakdown in the U.S.? Well, growth stocks were up 5.5%. Value stocks were only up 1.5%. And growth stocks are now at their highest relative level to value stocks since 2000, since right in the height of the tech bubble in 2000. So something we're watching for a long time. A lot of attention has gotten called in the past week to the, quote, longest bull market ever. I just thought I'd address that. It's really kind of a media creation in a lot of ways. Obviously, there's a lot of different ways to slice and dice what measures a bull market. Do you look at strictly 20% downturns? Do you look at the close or intraday? Do you look at price or dividends? Do you look at large caps or the whole U.S. universe? And this is really the longest if the downturn was more than 19.5%. So needless to say, there's a lot of ways to kind of slice and dice it, but that headline has been appearing over the past few weeks. What is clear is this bull market is very long in both strength and duration. The average time between a 20% drawdown, the market goes up about 131% and lasts a bit more than 1,200 days. We're currently up over 325% and almost 3,500 days, so roughly three times as long on this bull market. From a technical standpoint, every sector is positive and above both their 50 and 200-day moving average. So markets keep going up and momentum continues to be strong. Real quickly, two other small things. We got a nice tweet from the president last week talking about high consumer confidence, and he mentioned that it was the highest level since 2000, the 133.4% read from the Consumer Confidence Board. I went back and took a look at some analysis done by what does that mean for future market returns. And if you go back to kind of 1967, roughly the modern era, when the consumer confidence is in its highest decile, so that top 10%, the one-year forward returns for the stock market are about 4%. And that's versus about 12% for every period and about 19% when consumer confidence is in its lowest decile. So even though the consumer confidence is strong, it may be worthwhile looking at that as somewhat of a contrarian indicator. Last thing I'll mention, and this is going back to sounding like a broken record, but volatility continues to be exceptionally low, and we keep breaking decades-long records. The S&P for the month of August never moved up or down more than 0.8%, and that was the first time that's happened since LBJ was president in 1967. So, to wrap up, Dave, solid overall market, international dragged, especially in the emerging side, but the U.S. stock market really remained very, very strong, and the low volatility and bull market continued in August.
Great. Thank you for your comments, Austin, and thank you, everyone, for joining us this month. Join us again next month when we'll meet same time, 9 o'clock, on October 2nd. Thank you.